and were ending their days leisurely, when he saw those old Moscow ladies, the Moscow balls, and the English club, he felt himself at home in a quiet haven. In Moscow, he felt at peace, at home, warm and dirty, as in an old dressing gown. Moscow society, from the old women down to the children, received Pierre like a long-expected guest whose place was always ready awaiting him. For Moscow society, Pierre was the nicest, kindest, most intellectual, merriest, and most magnanimous of cranks, a heedless, genial nobleman of the old Russian type. His purse was always empty, because it was open to everyone. Benefit performances, bad pictures, statues, benevolent societies, gypsy choirs, schools, subscription dinners, sprees, Freemasons, churches and books, no one and nothing met with a refusal from him. And had it not been for two friends who had borrowed large sums from him and taken him under their protection, he would have given everything away. There was never a dinner or a soiree at the club without him. As soon as he sank into his place on the sofa after two bottles of Margaux, he was surrounded, and talking, disputing, and joking began. When there were quarrels, his kindly smile and well-timed jests reconciled the antagonists. The Masonic dinners were dull and dreary when he was not there. When after a bachelor supper he rose with his amiable and kindly smile, yielding to the entreaties of the festive company to drive off somewhere with them, shouts of delight and triumph arose among the young men. At balls he danced if a partner was needed. Young ladies, married and unmarried, liked him because without making love to any of them he was equally amiable to all, especially after supper. Il est charmant, il n'a pas de sexe. He is charming, he has no sex, they said of him. Pierre was one of those retired gentlemen-in-waiting of whom there were hundreds good-humouredly ending their days in Moscow. How horrified he would have been 7 years before, when he first arrived from abroad, had he been told that there was no need for him to seek or plan anything, that his rut had long been shaped, eternally predetermined, and that, wriggle as he might, he would be what all in his position were. He could not have believed it. Had he not at one time longed with all his heart to establish a republic in Russia? Then himself to be a Napoleon? Then to be a philosopher? And then a strategist and the conqueror of Napoleon? Had he not seen the possibility of, and passionately desired, the regeneration of the sinful human race and his own progress to the highest degree of perfection? Had he not established schools and hospitals and liberated his serfs? But instead of all that, here he was, the wealthy husband of an unfaithful wife, a retired gentleman in waiting, fond of eating and drinking, and as he unbuttoned his waistcoat, of abusing the government a bit, a member of the Moscow English Club and a universal favourite in Moscow society. For a long time he could not reconcile himself to the idea that he was one of those same retired Moscow gentlemen-in-waiting he had so despised 7 years before. Sometimes he consoled himself with the thought that he was only living this life temporarily, but then he was shocked by the thought of how many, like himself, had entered that life and that club temporarily, with all their teeth and hair, and had only left it when not a single tooth or hair remained. In moments of pride, when he thought of his position, it seemed to him that he was quite different and distinct from those other retired gentlemen-in-waiting he had formerly despised. They were empty, stupid, contented fellows, satisfied with their position. While I am still discontented and want to do something for mankind. But perhaps all these comrades of mine struggled just like me and sought something new, a path in life of their own, and like me were brought by force of circumstances, society and race, by that elemental force against which man is powerless, to the condition I am in, said he to himself in moments of humility. And after living some time in Moscow, he no longer despised, but began to grow fond of, to respect, and to pity his comrades in destiny, as he pitied himself. Pierre no longer suffered moments of despair, hypochondria, and disgust with life, but the malady that had formerly found expression in such acute attacks was driven inwards and never left him for a moment. What for? Why? What is going on in the world? He would ask himself in perplexity several times a day, involuntarily beginning to reflect anew on the meaning of the phenomena of life. But knowing by experience that there were no answers to these questions, he made haste to turn away from them, and took up a book, or hurried off to the club, or to Apollon Nikolaevich's to exchange the gossip of the town. Hélène, who has never cared for anything but her own body, and is one of the stupidest women in the world, thought Pierre, is regarded by people as the acme of intelligence and refinement, and they pay homage to her. Napoleon Bonaparte was despised by all as long as he was great, but now that he has become a wretched comedian, the Emperor Francis wants to offer him his daughter in an illegal marriage. The Spaniards, through the Catholic clergy, offer praise to God for their victory over the French on the 14th of June, and the French, also through the Catholic clergy, offer praise because on that same 14th of June they defeated the Spaniards. My brother Masons swear by the blood that they are ready to sacrifice everything for their neighbour, but they do not give a rouble each to the collections for the poor, and they intrigue, the Astrier Lodge against the Manor Seekers, and fuss about an authentic Scotch carpet and a charter that nobody needs, and the meaning of which the very man who wrote it does not understand. We all profess the Christian law of forgiveness of injuries and love of our neighbours, the law in honour of which we have built in Moscow 40 times 40 churches, but yesterday a deserter was knouted to death, and a minister of that same law of love and forgiveness, a priest, gave the soldier a cross to kiss before his execution. So thought Pierre, and the whole of this general deception which everyone accepts, accustomed as he was to it, astonished him each time as if it were something new. "I understand the deception and confusion," he thought, "but how am I to tell them all that I see? I have tried, and have always found that they too in the depths of their souls understand it as I do, and only try not to see it. So it appears that it must be so. But I, what is to become of me?" thought he. He had the unfortunate capacity many men, especially Russians, have of seeing and believing in the possibility of goodness and truth, but seeing the evil and falsehood of life too clearly to be able to take a serious part in it. Every sphere of work was connected in his eyes with evil and deception. Whatever he tried to be, whatever he engaged in, the evil and falsehood of it repulsed him and blocked every path of activity. Yet he had to live, and to find occupation. It was too dreadful to be under the burden of these insoluble problems, so he abandoned himself to any distraction in order to forget them. He frequented every kind of society, drank much, bought pictures, engaged in building, and above all, read. He read, and read everything that came to hand. On coming home, while his valets were still taking off his things, he picked up a book and began to read. From reading he passed to sleeping, from sleeping to gossip in drawing-rooms of the club, from gossip to carousals and women, from carousals back to gossip, reading and wine. Drinking became more and more a physical and also a moral necessity, though the doctors warned him that with his corpulence wine was dangerous for him, he drank a great deal. He was only quite at ease when, having poured several glasses of wine mechanically into his large mouth, he felt a pleasant warmth in his body, an amiability toward all his fellows, and a readiness to respond superficially to every idea without probing it deeply. Only after emptying a bottle or two did he feel dimly that the terrible, tangled skein of life which previously had terrified him was not as dreadful as he had thought. He was always conscious of some aspect of that skein, as with a buzzing in his head after dinner or supper he chatted or listened to conversation or read. But under the influence of wine he said to himself, "It doesn't matter. I'll get it unravelled. I have a solution ready, but have no time now. I'll think it all out later on." But the later on never came. In the morning, on an empty stomach, all the old questions appeared as insoluble and terrible as ever, and Pierre hastily picked up a book, and if anyone came to see him, he was glad. Sometimes he remembered how he had heard that soldiers in war, when entrenched under the enemy's fire, if they have nothing to do, try hard to find some occupation the more easily to bear the danger. To Pierre, all men seemed like those soldiers, seeking refuge from life. Some in ambition, some in cards, some in framing laws, some in women, some in toys, some in horses, some in politics, some in sport, some in wine, and some in governmental affairs. Nothing is trivial, and nothing is important. It's all the same. Only to save oneself from it as best one can, thought Pierre. Only not to see it. That dreadful. It. Chapter 2. Prince Nikolai Bolkonski in Moscow. At the beginning of winter, Prince Nikolai Bolkonski and his daughter moved to Moscow. At that time, enthusiasm for the Emperor Alexander's regime had weakened, and a patriotic and anti-French tendency prevailed there. And this, together with his past and his intellect and his originality, at once made Prince Nikolai Bolkonski an object of particular respect to the Muscovites and the centre of the Moscow opposition to the government. The prince had aged very thin that year. He showed marked signs of senility by a tendency to fall asleep, forgetfulness of quite recent events, remembrance of remote ones, and the childish vanity with which he accepted the role of head of the Moscow opposition. In spite of all this, the old man inspired in all his visitors alike a feeling of respectful veneration, especially of an evening when he came in to tea in his old-fashioned coat and powdered wig, and, aroused by anyone, told his abrupt stories of the past or uttered yet more abrupt and scathing criticisms of the present. For them all, that old-fashioned house with its gigantic mirrors, pre-revolution furniture, powdered footmen, and the stern, shrewd old man, himself a relic of the past century, with his gentle daughter and the pretty Frenchwoman who were reverently devoted to him, presented a majestic and agreeable spectacle. But the visitors did not reflect that besides the couple of hours during which they saw their host, there were also 22 hours in the day during which the private and intimate life of the house continued. Latterly, that private life had become very trying for Princess Maria. There in Moscow she was deprived of her greatest pleasures, talks with the pilgrims, and the solitude which refreshed her at Bald Hills. And she had none of the advantages and pleasures of city life. She did not go out into society. Everyone knew that her father would not let her go anywhere without him, and his failing health prevented his going out himself, so that she was not invited to dinners and evening parties. She had quite abandoned the hope of getting married. She saw the coldness and malevolence with which the old prince received and dismissed the young men, possible suitors, who sometimes appeared at their house. She had no friends. During this visit to Moscow, she had been disappointed in the two who had been nearest to her. Mademoiselle Bourienne, with whom she had never been able to be quite frank, had now become unpleasant to her, and for various reasons Princess Maria avoided her. Julie, with whom she had corresponded for the last 5 years, was in Moscow, but proved to be quite alien to her when they met. Just then Julie, who by the death of her brothers had become one of the richest heiresses in Moscow, was in the full whirl of society pleasures. She was surrounded by young men who, she fancied, had suddenly learned to appreciate her worth. Julie was at that stage in the life of a society woman when she feels that her last chance of marrying has come and that her fate must be decided now or never. On Thursdays, Princess Maria remembered with a mournful smile that she now had no one to write to, since Julie, whose presence gave her no pleasure, was here, and they met every week. Like the old émigré who declined to marry the lady with whom he had spent his evenings for years, she regretted Julie's presence and having no one to write to. In Moscow, Princess Maria had no one to talk to, no one to whom to confide her sorrow, and much sorrow fell to her lot just then. The time for Prince Andrei's return and marriage was approaching, but his request to her to prepare his father for it had not been carried out. In fact, it seemed as if matters were quite hopeless, for at every mention of the young Countess Rostova, the old prince, who apart from that was usually in a bad temper, lost control of himself. Another lately added sorrow arose from the lessons she gave her 6-year-old nephew. To her consternation, she detected in herself, in relation to little Nikolai, some symptoms of her father's irritability. However often she told herself that she must not get irritable when teaching her nephew, almost every time that, pointer in hand, she sat down to show him the French alphabet, so she longed to pour her own knowledge quickly and easily into the child, who was already afraid that Auntie might at any moment get angry, that at his slightest inattention she trembled, became flustered and heated, raised her voice, and sometimes pulled him by the arm and put him in the corner. Having put him in the corner, she would herself begin to cry over her cruel, evil nature, and little Nikolai, following her example, would sob, and without permission would leave his corner, come to her, pull her wet hands from her face, and comfort her. But what distressed the princess most of all was her father's irritability, which was always directed against her and had of late amounted to cruelty. Had he forced her to prostrate herself to the ground all night? Had he beaten her or made her fetch wood or water? It would never have entered her mind to think her position hard. But this loving despot, the more cruel because he loved her and for that reason tormented himself and her, knew how not merely to hurt and humiliate her deliberately, but to show her that she was always to blame for everything. Of late he had exhibited a new trait that tormented Princess Maria more than anything else. This was his ever-increasing intimacy with Mademoiselle Bourienne. The idea that at the first moment of receiving the news of his son's intentions had occurred to him in jest, that if Andrei got married he himself would marry Bourienne, had evidently pleased him, and latterly he had persistently, and as it seemed to Princess Maria, merely to offend her, shown special endearments to the companion, and expressed his dissatisfaction with his daughter by demonstrations of love of Bourienne. One day in Moscow, in Princess Maria's presence, she thought her father did it purposely when she was there, the old prince kissed Mademoiselle Bourienne's hand, and drawing her to him, embraced her affectionately. Princess Maria flushed and ran out of the room. A few minutes later, Mademoiselle Bourienne came into Princess Maria's room, smiling and making cheerful remarks in her agreeable voice. Princess Maria hastily wiped away her tears, went resolutely up to Mademoiselle Bourienne, and evidently unconscious of what she was doing, began shouting in angry haste at the Frenchwoman, her voice breaking. "It's horrible, vile, inhuman to take advantage of the weakness!" She did not finish. "Leave my room!" she exclaimed, and burst into sobs. Next day the prince did not say a word to his daughter. But she noticed that at dinner he gave orders that Mademoiselle Bourienne should be served first. After dinner, when the footman handed coffee and from habit began with the princess, the prince suddenly grew furious, threw his stick at Philip, and instantly gave instructions to have him conscripted for the army.
"He doesn't obey. I said it twice, and he doesn't obey. She is the first person in this house. She's my best friend," cried the prince. "And if you allow yourself..." he screamed in a fury, addressing Princess Maria for the first time, "to forget yourself again before her, as you dared to do yesterday, I will show you who is master in this house. Go, don't let me set eyes on you. Beg her pardon."
Princess Maria asked Mademoiselle Bourienne's pardon, and also her father's pardon for herself and for Philip the footman, who had begged for her intervention. At such moments, something like a pride of sacrifice gathered in her soul. And suddenly, that father whom she had judged would look for his spectacles in her presence, fumbling near them and not seeing them, or would forget something that had just occurred, or take a false step with his failing legs and turn to see if anyone had noticed his feebleness, or worst of all, at dinner, when there were no visitors to excite him, would suddenly fall asleep, letting his napkin drop and his shaking head sink over his plate.
He is old and feeble, and I dare to condemn him, she thought at such moments, with a feeling of revulsion against herself.
Chapter 3. Dr. Métivier and the Old Prince. In 1811 there was living in Moscow a French doctor, Métivier, who had rapidly become the fashion. He was enormously tall, handsome, amiable as Frenchmen are, and was, as all Moscow said, an extraordinarily clever doctor. He was received in the best houses not merely as a doctor, but as an equal. Prince Nikolai had always ridiculed medicine, but latterly, on Mademoiselle Bourienne's advice, had allowed this doctor to visit him and had grown accustomed to him. Métivier came to see the prince about twice a week. On December the 6th, St. Nikolai's Day and the prince's name day, all Moscow came to the prince's front door, but he gave orders to admit no one and to invite to dinner only a small number, a list of whom he gave to Princess Maria. Métivier, who came in the morning with his felicitations, considered it proper in his quality of doctor de forcer la consigne, to force entry, as he told Princess Maria, and went in to see the prince. It happened that on that morning of his name day the prince was in one of his worst moods. He had been going about the house all the morning, finding fault with everyone, and pretending not to understand what was said to him, and not to be understood himself. Princess Maria well knew this mood of quiet, absorbed querulousness, which generally culminated in a burst of rage, and she went about all that morning as though facing a cocked and loaded gun and awaited the inevitable explosion. Until the doctor's arrival, the morning had passed off safely. After admitting the doctor, Princess Maria sat down with a book in the drawing-room, near the door through which she could hear all that passed in the study. At first she heard only Métivier's voice, then her father's. Then both voices began speaking at the same time. The door was flung open, and on the threshold appeared the handsome figure of the terrified Métivier, with his shock of black hair, and the prince in his dressing-gown and fez, his face distorted with fury, and the pupils of his eyes rolled downwards.
"You don't understand!" shouted the prince. "But I do! French spy! Slave of Bonaparte! Spy, get out of my house! Be off, I tell you!"
Métivier, shrugging his shoulders, went up to Mademoiselle Bourienne, who, at the sound of shouting, had run in from an adjoining room. "The prince is not very well. Bile and a rush of blood to the head. Keep calm. I will call again tomorrow," said Métivier, and putting his fingers to his lips, he hastened away. Through the study door came the sound of slippered feet and the cry, "Spies! Traitors! Traitors everywhere! Not a moment's peace in my own house!" After Métivier's departure, the old prince called his daughter in, and the whole weight of his wrath fell on her. She was to blame that a spy had been admitted. Had he not told her? Yes, told her to make a list, and not to admit anyone who was not on that list. Then why was that scoundrel admitted? She was the cause of it all. With her, he said, he could not have a moment's peace and could not die quietly.
No, ma'am. We must part. We must part. Understand that. Understand it. I cannot endure any more, he said, and left the room.
Then, as if afraid she might find some means of consolation, he returned and, trying to appear calm, added,
"And don't imagine I have said this in a moment of anger. I am calm. I have thought it over, and it will be carried out. We must part. So find some place for yourself."
But he could not restrain himself, and with the virulence of which only one who loves is capable, evidently suffering himself, he shook his fist at her and screamed,
"If only some fool would marry her!"
Then he slammed the door, sent for Mademoiselle Bourienne, and subsided into his study. At 2 o'clock the 6 chosen guests assembled for dinner. These guests, the famous Count Rostopchin, Prince Lopukhin with his nephew, General Chatrov, an old war comrade of the prince's, and of the younger generation, Pierre and Boris Drubetskoy, awaited the prince in the drawing-room. Boris, who had come to Moscow on leave a few days before, had been anxious to be presented to Prince Nikolai Bolkonski and had contrived to ingratiate himself so well that the old prince in his case made an exception to the rule of not receiving bachelors in his house. The prince's house did not belong to what is known as fashionable society, but his little circle, though not much talked about in town, was one it was more flattering to be received in than any other. Boris had realized this the week before, when the commander-in-chief in his presence invited Rostopchin to dinner on St. Nikolai's Day, and Rostopchin had replied that he could not come. "On that day, I always go to pay my devotions to the relics of Prince Nikolai Bolkonski." "Oh, yes, yes," replied the commander-in-chief. "How is he?" The small group that assembled before dinner in the lofty old-fashioned drawing-room with its old furniture resembled the solemn gathering of a court of justice. All were silent or talked in low voices. Prince Nikolai came in serious and taciturn. Princess Maria seemed even quieter and more diffident than usual. The guests were reluctant to address her, feeling that she was in no mood for their conversation. Count Rostopchin alone kept the conversation going, now relating the latest town news and now the latest political gossip. Lopukhin and the old general occasionally took part in the conversation. Prince Bolkonski listened as a presiding judge receives a report, only now and then, silently or by a brief word, showing that he took heed of what was being reported to him. The tone of the conversation was such as indicated that no one approved of what was being done in the political world. Incidents were related, evidently confirming the opinion that everything was going from bad to worse, but whether telling a story or giving an opinion, the speaker always stopped, or was stopped, at the point beyond which his criticism might touch the sovereign himself. At dinner, the talk turned on the latest political news: Napoleon's seizure of the Duke of Oldenburg's territory, and the Russian note, hostile to Napoleon, which had been sent to all the European courts. "Bonaparte treats Europe as a pirate does a captured vessel," said Count Rostopchin, repeating a phrase he had uttered several times before. "One only wonders at the long-suffering or blindness of the crowned heads. Now the Pope's turn has come, and Bonaparte doesn't scruple to depose the head of the Catholic Church. Yet all keep silent. Our sovereign alone has protested against the seizure of the Duke of Oldenburg's territory, and even then..." Count Rostopchin paused, feeling that he had reached the limit beyond which censure was impossible.
"Other territories have been offered in exchange for the Duchy of Oldenburg," said Prince Bolkonski. "He shifts the dukes about as I might move my serfs from Bald Hills to Bogacharova or my Ryazan estates."
"The Duke of Oldenburg bears his misfortunes with admirable strength of character and resignation," remarked Boris, joining in respectfully. He said this because on his journey from Petersburg he had had the honour of being presented to the Duke. Prince Bolkonski glanced at the young man as if about to say something in reply, but changed his mind, evidently considering him too young.
"I have read our protests about the Oldenburg affair, and was surprised how badly the note was worded," remarked Count Rostopchin in the casual tone of a man dealing with a subject quite familiar to him.
Pierre looked at Rostopchin with naive astonishment, not understanding why he should be disturbed by the bad composition of the note.
"Does it matter, Count, how the note is worded?" he asked, "so long as its substance is forcible?"
"My dear fellow, with our 500,000 troops, it should be easy to have a good style," returned Count Rostopchin.
Pierre now understood the Count's dissatisfaction with the wording of the note.
"One would have thought quill drivers enough had sprung up," remarked the old prince. "There in Petersburg, they're always writing, not notes, but even new laws. My Andrei there has written a whole volume of laws for Russia. Nowadays they're always writing,"
and he laughed unnaturally. There was a momentary pause in the conversation. The old general cleared his throat to draw attention.
"Did you hear of the last event of the review in Petersburg, the figure cut by the new French ambassador.
Eh? Yes, I heard something. He said something awkward in His Majesty's presence.
His Majesty drew attention to the Grenadier Division and to the march past, continued the General, and it seems the ambassador took no notice and allowed himself to reply that we in France pay no attention to such trifles. The Emperor did not condescend to reply. At the next review, they say, the Emperor did not once deign to address him.
All were silent. On this fact relating to the Emperor personally, it was impossible to pass any judgment.
"Impudent fellows," said the Prince. "You know Metivier? I turned him out of my house this morning. He was here. They admitted him in spite of my request that they should let no one in,"
he went on, glancing angrily at his daughter. And he narrated his whole conversation with the French doctor and the reasons that convinced him that Metivier was a spy. Though these reasons were very insufficient and obscure, no one made any rejoinder. After the roast, champagne was served. The guests rose to congratulate the old prince. Princess Maria, too, went round to him. He gave her a cold, angry look and offered her his wrinkled, clean-shaven cheek to kiss. The whole expression of his face told her that he had not forgotten the morning's talk, that his decision remained in force, and only the presence of visitors hindered his speaking of it to her now. When they went into the drawing-room, where coffee was served, the old men sat together. Princess Nikolai grew more animated and expressed his views on the impending war. He said that our wars with Bonaparte would be disastrous as long as we sought alliances with the Germans and thrust ourselves into European affairs, into which we had been drawn by the Peace of Tilsit.
"We ought not to fight either for or against Austria. Our political interests are all in the East, and in regard to Bonaparte, the only thing is to have an armed frontier and a firm policy, and he will never dare to cross the Russian frontier, as was the case in 1807.
"How can we fight the French, Prince?" said Count Rostopchin.
"Can we arm ourselves against our teachers and divinities? Look at our youths, look at our ladies. The French are our gods. Paris is our kingdom of heaven."
He began speaking louder, evidently to be heard by everyone.
"French dresses, French ideas, French feelings. There now, you turned Metivier out by the scruff of his neck because he is a Frenchman and a scoundrel. But our ladies crawl after him on their knees.
I went to a party last night, and there, out of five ladies, three were Roman Catholics and had the Pope's indulgence for doing wool work on Sundays. And they themselves sit there nearly naked, like the signboards at our public baths, if I may say so. Ah, when one looks at our young people, Prince, one would like to take Peter the Great's old cudgel out of the museum and belabour them in the Russian way, till all the nonsense jumps out of them." All were silent. The old prince looked at Rostopchin with a smile and wagged his head approvingly.
"Well, goodbye, Your Excellency. Keep well," said Rostopchin, getting up with characteristic briskness and holding out his hand to the prince. "Goodbye, my dear fellow. His words are music. I never tire of hearing him," said the old prince, keeping hold of the hand and offering his cheek to be kissed.
Following Rostopchin's example, the others also rose. Chapter 4. Pierre's Conversation with Princess Maria. Princess Maria, as she sat listening to the old men's talk and fault-finding, understood nothing of what she heard. She only wondered whether the guests had all observed her father's hostile attitude toward her. She did not even notice the special attentions and amiabilities shown her during dinner by Boris Trubetskoy, who was visiting them for the third time already. Princess Maria turned with an absent-minded, questioning look to Pierre, who, hat in hand and with a smile on his face, was the last of the guests to approach her after the old prince had gone out and they were left alone in the drawing-room. "May I stay a little longer?" he said, letting his stout body sink into an armchair beside her. "Oh, yes," she answered. "You noticed nothing?" her look asked. Pierre was in an agreeable after-dinner mood. He looked straight before him and smiled quietly. "Have you known that young man long, Princess?" he asked.
"Who?"
"Drubetskoy."
"No, not long."
"Do you like him?"
"Yes, he is an agreeable young man. Why do you ask me that?" said Princess Maria, still thinking of that morning's conversation with her father.
"Because I have noticed that when a young man comes on leave from Petersburg to Moscow, it is usually with the object of marrying an heiress."
"You have observed that?" said Princess Maria.
"Yes," returned Pierre with a smile, "and this young man now manages matters so that where there is a wealthy heiress, there he is too. I can read him like a book. At present he is hesitating whom to lay siege to, you or Mademoiselle Julie Karagina. He is very attentive to her."
"He visits them?"
"Yes, very often. And you know the new way of courting," said Pierre with an amused smile, evidently in that cheerful mood of good-humoured raillery for which he so often reproached himself in his diary.
"No," replied Princess Maria.
"To please Moscow girls nowadays, one has to be melancholy. He is very melancholy with Mademoiselle Karagina," said Pierre.
"Really?"
asked Princess Maria, looking into Pierre's kindly face and still thinking of her own sorrow.
"It would be a relief," thought she, "if I ventured to confide what I am feeling to someone. I should like to tell everything to Pierre. He is kind and generous. It would be a relief. He would give me advice."
"Would you marry him?"
"Oh, my God, Count, there are moments when I would marry anybody," she cried suddenly to her own surprise and with tears in her voice. "Ah, how bitter it is to love someone near to you and to feel that," she went on in a trembling voice, "that you can do nothing for him but grieve him, and to know that you cannot alter this. Then there is only one thing left, to go away. But where could I go?"
"What is wrong? What is it, Princess?" But without finishing what she was saying, Princess Maria burst into tears.
"I don't know what is the matter with me today. Don't take any notice. Forget what I have said."
Pierre's gaiety vanished completely. He anxiously questioned the princess, asked her to speak out fully and confide her grief to him, but she only repeated that she begged him to forget what she had said, that she did not remember what she had said, and that she had no trouble except the one he knew of, that Prince Andrei's marriage threatened to cause a rupture between father and son.
"Have you any news of the Rostovs?" she asked, to change the subject. "I was told that they are coming soon. I'm also expecting Andrei any day. I should like them to meet here."
"And how does he now regard the matter?" asked Pierre, referring to the old prince. Princess Maria shook her head.
"What is to be done? In a few months a year will be up. The thing is impossible. I only wish I could spare my brother the first moments. I wish they would come sooner. I hope to be friends with her."
"You have known them a long time," said Princess Maria. "Tell me honestly the whole truth. What sort of girl is she, and what do you think of her?
The real truth, because you know Andrei is risking so much doing this against his father's will that I should like to know."
An undefined instinct told Pierre that these explanations and repeated requests to be told the whole truth expressed ill will on the princess's part toward her future sister-in-law, and a wish that he should disapprove of Andrei's choice. But in reply, he said what he felt rather than what he thought.
"I don't know how to answer your question," he said, blushing without knowing why. "I really don't know what sort of a girl she is. I can't analyse her at all. She is enchanting, but what makes her so, I don't know. That is all one can say about her."
Princess Maria sighed, and the expression on her face said, "Yes, that's what I expected and feared."
"Is she clever?" she asked.
Pierre considered. "I think not," he said. "And yet, yes. She does not deign to be clever. Oh, no, She is simply enchanting, and that is all." Princess Maria again shook her head disapprovingly. "Ah, I so long to like her. Tell her so if you see her before I do." "I hear they are expected very soon," said Pierre. Princess Maria told Pierre of her plan to become intimate with her future sister-in-law as soon as the Rostovs arrived, and to try to accustom the old prince to her. Chapter 5. Boris's Proposal. Boris had not succeeded in making a wealthy match in Petersburg, so with the same object in view he came to Moscow. There he wavered between the two richest heiresses, Julie and Princess Maria. Though Princess Maria, despite her plainness, seemed to him more attractive than Julie, he, without knowing why, felt awkward about paying court to her. When they had last met on the old prince's name day, she had answered at random all his attempts to talk sentimentally, evidently not listening to what he was saying. Julie, on the contrary, accepted his attentions readily, though in a manner peculiar to herself. She was 27. After the death of her brothers, she had become very wealthy. She was by now decidedly plain, but thought herself not merely as good-looking as before, but even far more attractive. She was confirmed in this delusion by the fact that she had become a very wealthy heiress, and also by the fact that the older she grew, the less dangerous she became to men, and the more freely they could associate with her and avail themselves of her suppers, soirees, and the animated company that assembled at her house, without incurring any obligation. A man who would have been afraid 10 years before of going every day to the house where there was a girl of 17 there, for fear of compromising her and committing himself, would now go boldly every day and treat her not as a marriageable girl, but as a sexless acquaintance. That winter, the Karagins' house was the most agreeable and hospitable in Moscow. In addition to the formal evening and dinner parties, a large company, chiefly of men, gathered there every day, supping at midnight and staying till 3 in the morning. Julie never missed a ball, a promenade, or a play. Her dresses were always of the latest fashion. But in spite of that, she seemed to be disillusioned about everything, and told everyone that she did not believe either in friendship, or in love, or in any of the joys of life, and expected peace only yonder. She adopted the tone of one who has suffered a great disappointment, like a girl who has either lost the man she loved or been cruelly deceived by him. Though nothing of the kind had happened to her, she was regarded in that light, and had even herself come to believe that she had suffered much in life. This melancholy, which did not prevent her amusing herself, did not hinder the young people who came to her house from passing the time pleasantly. Every visitor who came to the house paid his tribute to the melancholy mood of the hostess, and then amused himself with society gossip, dancing, intellectual games, and bouts rimés, which were in vogue at the Karagins'. Only a few of these young men, among them Boris, entered more deeply into Julie's melancholy, and with these she had prolonged conversations in private on the vanity of all worldly things, and to them she showed her albums filled with mournful sketches, maxims, and verses. To Boris, Julie was particularly gracious. She regretted his early disillusionment with life, offered him such consolation of friendship as she who had herself suffered so much could render, and showed him her album. Boris sketched 2 trees in the album and wrote, "Rustic trees, your dark branches shed gloom and melancholy upon me." On another page he drew a tomb and wrote in French, "Death gives relief and death is peaceful. Ah, from suffering there is no other refuge." Julie said this was charming.
"There is something so enchanting in the smile of melancholy," she said to Boris, repeating word for word a passage she had copied from a book. "It is a ray of light in the darkness, a shade between sadness and despair, showing the possibility of consolation."
In reply, Boris wrote these lines, "Poisonous nourishment of a too sensitive soul, thou without whom happiness would for me be impossible, tender melancholy, ah, come to console me, come to calm the torments of my gloomy retreat, and mingle a secret sweetness with these tears that I feel to be flowing. For Boris, Julie played most doleful nocturnes on her harp. Boris read Poor Liza aloud to her, and more than once interrupted the reading because of the emotions that choked him. Meeting at large gatherings, Julie and Boris looked on one another as the only souls who understood one another in a world of indifferent people. Anna Mikhailovna, who often visited the Karagins, while playing cards with the mother, made careful inquiries as to Julie's dowry. She was to have two estates in Penza and the Nizhegorod forests. Anna Mikhailovna regarded the refined sadness that united her son to the wealthy Julie with emotion and resignation to the divine will. "You are always charming and melancholy, my dear Julie," she said to the daughter. "Boris says his soul finds repose at your house. He has suffered so many disappointments and is so sensitive," said she to the mother. "Ah, my dear, I can't tell you how fond I have grown of Julie latterly," she said to her son. "But who could help loving her? She is an angelic being." "Ah, Boris, Boris," she paused. "And how I pity her mother," she went on. "Today she showed me her accounts and letters from Penza. They have enormous estates there, and she, poor thing, has no one to help her. And they do cheat her so." Boris smiled almost imperceptibly while listening to his mother. He laughed blandly at her naive diplomacy, but listened to what she had to say, and sometimes questioned her carefully about the Penza and Nizhegorod estates. Julie had long been expecting a proposal from her melancholy adorer, and was ready to accept it. But some secret feeling of repulsion for her passionate desire to get married, for her artificiality, and a feeling of horror at renouncing the possibility of real love, still restrained Boris. His leave was expiring. He spent every day and whole days at the Karagins, and every day on thinking the matter over told himself that he would propose tomorrow. But in Julie's presence, looking at her red face and chin, nearly always powdered, her moist eyes, and her expression of continual readiness to pass at once from melancholy to an unnatural rapture of married bliss, Boris could not utter the decisive words, though in imagination he had long regarded himself as the possessor of those Penza and Nizhegorod estates, and had apportioned the use of the income from them. Julie saw Boris's indecision, and sometimes the thought occurred to her that she was repulsive to him, but her feminine self-deception immediately supplied her with consolation, and she told herself that he was only shy from love. Her melancholy, however, began to turn to irritability, and not long before Boris's departure she formed a definite plan of action. Just as Boris's leave of absence was expiring, Anatole made his appearance in Moscow, and of course in the Karagins' drawing-room, and Julie, suddenly abandoning her melancholy, became cheerful and very attentive to Anatole. "My dear," said Anna Mikhailovna to her son, "I know from a reliable source that Prince Vasily has sent his son to Moscow to get him married to Julie. I am so fond of Julie that I should be sorry for her. What do you think of it, my dear?" The idea of being made a fool of, and of having thrown away that whole month of arduous, melancholy service to Julie, and of seeing all the revenue from the Penza estates, which he had already mentally apportioned and put to proper use, fall into the hands of another, and especially into the hands of that idiot Anatole, pained Boris. He drove to the Karagins with the firm intention of proposing. Julie met him in a gay, careless manner, spoke casually of how she had enjoyed yesterday's ball, and asked when he was leaving. Though Boris had come intentionally to speak of his love, and therefore meant to be tender, he began speaking irritably of feminine inconstancy, of how easily women can turn from sadness to joy, and how their moods depend solely on who happens to be paying court to them. Julie was offended, and replied that it was true that a woman needs variety, and the same thing over and over again would weary anyone. "Then I should advise you," Boris began, wishing to sting her. But at that instant the galling thought occurred to him that he might have to leave Moscow without having accomplished his aim, and have vainly wasted his efforts, which was a thing he never allowed to happen. He checked himself in the middle of the sentence, lowered his eyes to avoid seeing her unpleasantly irritated and irresolute face, and said, "I did not come here at all to quarrel with you. On the contrary." He glanced at her to make sure that he might go on. Her irritability had suddenly quite vanished, and her anxious, imploring eyes were fixed on him with greedy expectation. "I can always arrange so as not to see her often," thought Boris. "The affair has been begun and must be finished." He blushed hotly, raised his eyes to hers, and said, "You know my feelings for you." There was no need to say more. Julie's face shone with triumph and self-satisfaction, but she forced Boris to say all that is said on such occasions, that he loved her and that he had never loved any other woman more than her. She knew that for the Penza estates and the Nizhegorod forests she could demand this, and she received what she demanded. The affianced couple, no longer alluding to trees that shed gloom and melancholy upon them, planned the arrangements of a splendid house in Petersburg, paid calls, and prepared everything for a brilliant wedding. Chapter 6. The Rostovs stay with Maria Dmitrievna. At the end of January, old Count Rostov went to Moscow with Natasha and Sonya. The Countess was still unwell and unable to travel, but it was impossible to wait for her recovery. Prince Andrei was expected in Moscow any day, the trousseau had to be ordered, and the estate near Moscow had to be sold, besides which the opportunity of presenting his future daughter-in-law to old Prince Bolkonski while he was in Moscow could not be missed. Rostov's Moscow house had not been heated that winter, and as they had come only for a short time and the Countess was not with them, the Count decided to stay with Maria Dmitrievna Akhrosimova, who had long been pressing her hospitality on them. Late one evening the Rostovs' four sleighs drove into Maria Dmitrievna's courtyard in the old Konyushiny Street. Maria Dmitrievna lived alone. She had already married off her daughter, and her sons were all in the service. She held herself as erect, told everyone her opinion as candidly, loudly, and bluntly as ever, and her whole bearing seemed a reproach to others for any weakness, passion, or temptation, the possibility of which she did not admit. From early in the morning, wearing a dressing jacket, she attended to her household affairs, and then she drove out, on holy days to church, and after the service to jails and prisons, on affairs of which she never spoke to anyone. On ordinary days, after dressing, she received petitioners of various classes, of whom there were always some. Then she had dinner, a substantial and appetizing meal, at which there were always three or four guests. After dinner she played a game of Boston, and at night she had the newspapers or a new book read to her while she knitted. She rarely made an exception and went out to pay visits, and then only to the most important persons in the town. She had not yet gone to bed when the Rostovs arrived, and the pulley of the hall door squeaked from the cold as it let in the Rostovs and their servants. Maria Dmitrievna, with her spectacles hanging down on her nose and her head flung back, stood in the hall doorway looking with a stern, grim face at the new arrivals. One might have thought she was angry with the travellers and would immediately turn them out, had she not at the same time been giving careful instructions to the servants for the accommodation of the visitors and their belongings. "The Count's things? Bring them here," she said, pointing to the portmanteaus and not greeting anyone. "The young ladies? There to the left. Now, what are you dawdling for?" she cried to the maids. "Get the samovar ready. You've grown plumper and prettier," she remarked, drawing Natasha, whose cheeks were glowing from the cold, to her by the hood. "Phew! You're cold. Now take off your things, quick!" she shouted to the Count, who was going to kiss her hand. "You're half frozen, I'm sure. Bring some rum for tea. Bonjour, Sonia dear." she added, turning to Sonya and indicating by this French greeting her slightly contemptuous, though affectionate, attitude toward her. When they came into tea, having taken off their outdoor things and tidied themselves up after their journey, Marya Dmitrievna kissed them all in due order. "I'm heartily glad you've come and are staying with me. It was high time," she said, giving Natasha a significant look. "The old man is here, and his son's expected any day. You'll have to make his acquaintance, but we'll speak of that later on," she added, glancing at Sonya with a look that showed she did not want to speak of it in her presence. "Now listen," she said to the Count. "What do you want tomorrow? Whom will you send for? Shinshin?" She crooked one of her fingers. "The snivelling Anna Mikhailovna? That's two. She's here with her son. The son is getting married. Then Bezukhov, eh? He's here too, with his wife. He ran away from her, and she came galloping after him. He dined with me on Wednesday. As for them," and she pointed to the girls, "tomorrow I'll take them first to the Iberian shrine of the Mother of God, and then we'll drive to the Super Rogues. That's what we call Super Roguet, the dressmaker. I suppose you'll have everything new. Don't judge by me. Sleeves nowadays are this size. The other day, young Princess Irina Vasilievna came to see me. She was an awful sight. Looked as if she'd put two barrels on her arms. You know, not a day passes now without some new fashion. And what have you to do yourself?" she asked the Count sternly. "One thing has come on top of another. Her rags to buy, and now a purchaser has turned up for the Moscow estate and for the house. If you will be so kind, I'll fix a time and go down to the estate just for a day, and leave my lassies with you." "All right, all right. They'll be as safe with me, as safe as in Chancery. I'll take them where they must go, scold them a bit, and pet them a bit," said Marya Dmitrievna, touching her goddaughter and favourite Natasha on the cheek with her large hand. Next morning, Marya Dmitrievna took the young ladies to the Iberian shrine of the Mother of God and to Madame Super-Roguet, who was so afraid of Marya Dmitrievna that she always let her have costumes at a loss, merely to get rid of her. Marya Dmitrievna ordered almost the whole trousseau. When they got home, she turned everybody out of the room except Natasha, and then called her pet to her armchair. "Well, now we'll talk. I congratulate you on your betrothed. You've hooked a fine fellow. I'm glad for your sake, and I've known him since he was so high." She held her hand a couple of feet from the ground. Natasha blushed happily. "I like him and all his family. Now listen. You know that old Prince Nikolai much dislikes his son marrying. The old fellow's crotchety. Of course, Prince Andrei is not a child and can shift without him, but it's not nice to enter a family against a father's will. One wants to do it peacefully and lovingly. You're a clever girl, and you'll know how to manage. Be kind and use your wits, then all will be well." Natasha remained silent, from shyness, Marya Dmitrievna supposed, but really because she disliked anyone interfering in what touched her love of Prince Andrei, which seemed to her so apart from all human affairs that no one could understand it. She loved and knew Prince Andrei. He loved her only, and was to come one of these days and take her. She wanted nothing more. "You see, I have known him a long time, and am also fond of Marya, your future sister-in-law. Husband's sisters bring up blisters, but this one wouldn't hurt a fly. She has asked me to bring you two together. Tomorrow you'll go with your father to see her. Be very nice and affectionate to her. You're younger than she is. When he comes, he'll find you already know his sister and father and are liked by them. Am I right or not? Won't that be best?"
"Yes, it will,"
Natasha answered reluctantly. Chapter 7. Count Rostov and Natasha call on Prince Nikolai Bolkonski. Next day, by Marya Dmitrievna's advice, Count Rostov took Natasha to call on Prince Nikolai Bolkonski. The Count did not set out cheerfully on this visit. At heart he felt afraid. He well remembered the last interview he had had with the old prince at the time of the enrolment, when in reply to an invitation to dinner he had had to listen to an angry reprimand for not having provided his full quota of men. Natasha, on the other hand, having put on her best gown, was in the highest spirits.
"They can't help liking me," she thought. Everybody has always liked me, and I'm so willing to do anything they wish, so ready to be fond of him for being his father, and of her for being his sister, that there is no reason for them not to like me.
They drove up to the gloomy old house on the Vozdvizhenka and entered the vestibule.
"Well, the Lord have mercy on us," said the Count, half in jest, half in earnest.
But Natasha noticed that her father was flurried on entering the anteroom and inquired timidly and softly whether the prince and princess were at home. When they had been announced, a perturbation was noticeable among the servants. The footman who had gone to announce them was stopped by